Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Reunited at last, Tesca and Carla seek to escape the abbey through the caves below as the battle rages above. Chapter 41. The stable roof lay before Midgate, abandoned and burning. At the base of the wall, the remnants of the makeshift ladders were scattered in half-consumed ruins as fire moved steadily down their lengths. As the light from the burning wreckage illuminated the wall, occasionally the monks could be seen patrolling the battlements, flickering in and out of the night like fireflies.
"Kefi fire,"
Merritt said, standing next to Kelisandra and Padrick on the roof over Lowgate, his voice little more than an awed whisper.
"They have the Kefi fire!"
"Padrick,"
Kelisandra said in a flat tone, her gaze never wavering from the battlefield.
"Next time he speaks out a turn, throw him over the wall, you will."
"Aye, mum,"
the acolyte replied with a grin, taking a step closer to the quailing blessed. But Kelisandra paid them no further notice, her mind reeling from the unexpected defeat. The assault had begun as she'd planned. After letting Merritt guide the pilgrims in prayer, a dozen of them had lifted the stable roof onto their shoulders, while Rorik had led another dozen pilgrims beneath it, carrying the ram. Behind them, Donal, Timon, and Danis had waited with another 20 pilgrims, all armed with weapons liberated from the registry. Once the gate fell, they would surge through the breach and take the gatehouse. At the same time, four teams of pilgrims under Desmond's direction stormed the wall in different places, each carrying one of the new ladders. And behind all these were groups of crossbowmen, instructed to shoot at any defenders that revealed themselves. Padrick remained at her side, despite his protests, saying that the elf hadn't hurt him that badly, that he was fit for combat. But she had remained firm, telling him that she couldn't trust one of the pilgrims to be her signaler, dispatching her orders with horn and flags. As her forces approached Midgate, she felt the thrill once more, the sun's purpose coursing through her, and realized she had been away from the front for too long. This was where she belonged, commanding troops in pursuit of the sun's work, bringing his wrath to the enemies of the Triad. She felt fully awake, alive, all her senses capturing every detail. Midgate would fall, and if her boys were swift, they might even seize Highgate before the monks could close it. Then she'd have Banbrook and the elf, and after that, force them to give Molly back to her.
"Lying he was," she had thought, "lying second nature to that old pirate. See my girl wheeling about on those crutches again, I will. Neither healed nor damned."
It wasn't until she had seen that first group of monks appear on the wall that she felt the first flutter of concern. There were four of them, all wearing the protective clothing she'd seen in the preservatory's alchemy labs, aprons and long gloves made of thick leather and eyewear with large round lenses of smoked glass. One carried a large bucket, two more carried some sort of thick coiled rope between them, and the fourth, who kept his distance from the others. Her heart had skipped a beat when she saw the fourth monk carried a 6-foot pole with a bright flame on the end.
"Look like a Kefi fire squad, they do,"
Padrick had said in surprise.
"Can't be,"
she had hissed in disbelief, her lips curling back from her teeth in a grimace when she saw a second team of four come out of the gatehouse, followed by a third, then a fourth. She saw instantly that it was a race, her ladders against these teams of monks.
"Signal," she shouted, pounding her fist against the stone parapet. "Double time! Double time!"
Padrick grabbed the horn and raised it to his lips, but her forces were already engaged. Pilgrims were scrambling up the ladders even as they clattered against the wall, and the ram was drawing near to the gate, but the monks had a much shorter distance to cover. She had watched as one of the teams stopped near a ladder, the first monk setting down the bucket and pulling a large stopper out of the lid. Then he grabbed one end of the rope, which Kelisandra now recognized as a hose, and pushed it through the hole into the bucket. The next monk unplugged a second hole in the lid and inserted a strange device into it, a slender metal shaft with a large handle on one end. Then he began to pump the handle, steadily forcing the contents of the bucket up through the hose. The third monk held the other end of the hose, where a brass nozzle had been attached, aiming it at the ladder. After a dozen pumps, he opened the nozzle briefly, letting a spray of liquid gush forth, bathing the ladder and the first of the climbing pilgrims. Then, closing off the nozzle, he took a step back as the last monk darted forward, dropping his long torch onto the spattered liquid. Fire instantly flashed over the wet wood and the top climber, who screamed, frantically flailing at himself as he lost his balance and fell. The next pilgrims on the ladder balked, but were forced toward the flames by those below who had not yet realized the danger. The monks did not let up, the pump man steadily building up the pressure in the hose once more before the nozzle man released another stream.
"No," she whispered, her mind blank with shock as two of the other fire squads repeated the procedure against other ladders. Then she had a flash of hope. The rightmost ladder team, the one furthest from the gatehouse, was about to gain the wall, and the monks weren't in position yet. "Yes, yes, yes!" she shouted as the first pilgrim scrambled onto the wall. Suddenly, victory was within reach again. She could see it clearly. All the man had to do was charge the fire squad before they were ready, secure that makeshift flame weapon, and use it to advance down the wall to the gatehouse.
"Go, go!"
But the man on the wall wasn't one of her boys, who would have seen the situation as clearly as she did. Instead, it was a pilgrim, and he lingered by the ladder, waiting for more of his fellows to join him before advancing.
"No!" Kelisandra shrieked in frustration. "Don't wait, you fool! Get going!"
10 seconds they delayed, building up their numbers and their confidence, and Kelisandra could only watch in impotent rage when they finally charged, yelling and shouting, toward the monks who were now ready for them. Merrick cried out in horror, and even Patrick winced as the hapless men ran headlong into the fiery blast. Kelisandra didn't watch them die. She had already shifted her attention to the ram, her last hope. But two more of the fire squads had appeared atop the middle gate. One team aimed their spray onto the stable roof, engulfing the front half in flames, while the other pumped a stream onto the ground between the ram and the portcullis. The lead pilgrims balked as the flaming liquid flowed under their feet, letting go of the roof as they jumped away, and the structure pitched forward onto the ground, trapping several men beneath it. As the others behind tried to rescue their fellows, a steady volley of crossbow bolts flew from ports in the gatehouse, felling several more. Kelisandra was forcibly reminded of an anthill after a child had stomped on it. Her ordered lines had broken into a panicked frenzy, people running this way and that. All the while, the monks continued to pump fire onto Kelisandra's siege equipment, hastening their destruction. Her jaw began to ache, drawing her out of her reverie, and she realized she'd been clenching her teeth since the first fire squad had appeared.
"Ordered you were to learn the monks' defenses," she said, glaring at Patrick.
The acolyte wilted beneath her gaze.
"We did, Mum, by the sword and shield, I swear. If they'd barrels of naphtha set aside, we'd have found out."
She slapped her hand down on the stone.
"Something new, then. Something Banbrook didn't have before."
She paused, sniffing the air.
"What do you smell?"
Patrick sniffed as well.
"There's nothing."
"Aye," she said, "nothing. What's the thing about Kefi Fire you remember most?"
Patrick looked puzzled. Then he nodded.
"The smell. Sharp, strong. Can't get it out of your nose for days."
"Aye," she said. "So it's not proper naphtha we're facing."
She studied the fires for a moment.
"Doesn't burn so hot, either. Be more ash out there than fire already, if it did."
She gave the weeping Merritt a withering glance.
"Enough to make these farmers stain their breeches and run, though."
Patrick grimly chuckled as Donal and Timon came up the stairs onto the roof, smears of soot and sweat across their faces. Both men saluted her.
"Casualties, Lieutenant."
15 dead, Mum," Donal reported, gravely accepting a sheathed sword from Timon.
Kelisandra's face drew taut, and Padraic swore an oath as Donal handed the blade to his commander.
"Rorik?" she asked, recognizing the weapon.
"Aye, mum. Trapped under the roof when it fell. Took a bolt in the neck as we pulled him out."
Donal hung his head.
"Truth to tell, mum, burned as he was, like as not the bolt was a mercy."
"The enemy's not to be thanked for mercy, Lieutenant," Kelisandra snapped. "Their heresy it is that's the root of all this, and answer for it they will."
"Aye, mum," Donal replied, resuming his tally after an awkward pause.
7 wounded, minor burns or broken ankles from jumping off ladders. All the siege equipment's destroyed as well."
"Can see that from here," she replied, turning to look back at the battlefield.
She remained silent for a moment, then pointed down at the smithy.
"Easiest to take apart next, I think. Start work on a new roof and ram, and more ladders, at least 8.
Donald didn't respond at once. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw him and Timon share a glance.
"What is it? If there's aught I need here, now's the time."
She turned her head to look directly at Donal.
"Knew that without needing to be told, Angus did."
Donal flushed, swallowed, and snapped to attention.
"Aye, mum. Been hearing talk among the faithful we have. Fire spooked them."
"Some among them say they'll not charge the wall again," Timon added angrily.
"Do they now?" Kelisandra said.
"There's more," Donal went on. "Getting more questions about water even before the attack we were, and battle's thirsty work. Know the well's gone dry, they do. Fear there's not enough water for everyone."
"There isn't," Padraic snarled. "Not if we stay this side of Midgate. If those bleating sheep want a drink of water, they'll have to brave the fire."
"And if they turn on us out of fear," Donal said, "there's enough of those sheep to trample us under."
"Silence," Kelisandra ordered, her voice cracking like a whip. "Molly's out there, she is," she said, stabbing her finger out into the night, past the abandoned campsite. "Spy has her. Best chance to get her back is to take the abbey. With the elf in our hands, the spy'll have to come to us. For that to happen, need the sheep to do as they're told."
As her soldiers settled down, her gaze fell on Merritt, still cowering next to the battlements.
"Listen to one of the blessed more than us, they will. Get him up."
Timon hauled Merritt to his feet and dragged him in front of the commander.
"Another chance for a pretty speech, little man," she said with distaste. "Here's what you'll be telling him. It's not Kefi fire they're facing. Most like it's the monk's lamp oil, with a bit of this and that thrown in. Doesn't burn hot enough to kill you, if you've the wits to wipe it off quick."
Behind Merritt, she saw Donal and Timon's dubious expressions and warned them to stay silent with a quick gesture.
"The monks used a lot of oil on the last attack. Can't have much more. So, now it's a bit of cat and mouse with them. We come in close and make them use their fire, then back off and come at them somewhere else. We'll have ladders aplenty to spare. That's why we need 8 of them this time. Force them to use their fire over and over until they're out of oil. Then we have them. Remember all that, do you?"
Merritt nodded.
"Good. Because you're first up one of those new ladders if you get it wrong."
She looked at Timon.
"Stay with him. Like as not he'll say more than he should otherwise."
Timon gave her a knowing smile as he saluted and half-dragged Merritt to the steps.
"Building that many ladders and dismantling the smithy will take the rest of the night," Donal pointed out.
"Keeps the sheep too busy to ask more questions," Kelisandra replied.
"Aye, but they'll be thirstier still when the work's done."
"When the work's done," she growled, "either we're in Midgate, swimming in Banbrook cisterns, or there'll be enough water in Lowgate for the few of us that are left."
She paused, struggling to get herself under control.
"Have faith, Donal," she said at last. "The sun doesn't put his swords to easy tasks."
Donal saluted.
"Aye, mum."
He waited a moment, then,
"We all want her back."
She closed her eyes.
"Aye."
Then she opened them, hearing footsteps on the stairs. A moment later, Desmond came onto the roof and saluted.
"Mum, one of the prisoners we left in the farmhouse. He's here. Says he knows another way into the abbey, he does."
She hesitated, glancing at Donal, who gave her a puzzled shrug.
"Trust in the sun," she breathed.
the bringer of victory. She returned Desmond's salute. Bring him up. A few minutes later, Desmond returned, bringing the man in question with her. It was indeed one of the two men Angus and his squad had captured last night. He was blonde and burly, and her experienced eye noticed that he favored his right leg as he walked.
"Gave the left knee a good deal of attention last night, Padraic did," she remembered.
Despite the limp, the bruises mottling his face, and the gap in his smile where a gold tooth had been, Ambrose Fane stood tall and proud. He looked at Kelisandra and gave her a respectful nod.
"Think we got off on the wrong foot, ma'am?"
"Which time?" she asked. "When you attacked our caravan on the road, or when you were found spying on us, wearing clothes stained with the fresh blood of the faithful?"
Ambrose sighed and spread his hands, ceding the point.
"Misunderstandings that can be sorted out, ma'am. I've not harmed any of your folks, save when they attacked me first. That's how it was on the road. Your man there can attest to that," he added, pointing to Donal. "We were talking, that's all, sorting out matters. It was the pirate that got your people all worked up with a prayer. One of them threw a stone at us, that's what started it. We just did our best to get away."
"And the clothes you wear now?"
"Blood of your folk on them, to be sure. But it's no blood I've spilled, that's the sun's truth. You want their killer after all this is over? I'd be glad to arrange it. But that's not why I'm here."
Kelisandra chuckled.
"Thought you'd had enough of our hospitality last night. Curious what's so important you come back for more. Here you've something to tell me."
"Something to sell you," Ambrose corrected. He glanced toward Midgate. "Looks to me as if you spent all day banging on the monk's front door."
His missing tooth was a single dark space in his wide grin.
"Perhaps you'd like to try the back."
"Trust in the sun," Kelisandra thought, feeling a flutter of hope. "Perhaps. Told us a great deal last night, you did. Never said a word about a back door then."
"Didn't know about it then."
"Well, why don't we just pick up from where we left off?" she said, glancing at Padraic.
Ambrose regarded the acolyte warily as Padraic took an eager step forward, but he held his ground.
"Won't get far that way," he warned her. "The door I'm talking about needs a key."
"And where's this key?"
Ambrose smiled.
"I couldn't tell you."
He gestured vaguely at the darkness outside the abbey.
"My cousin's out there somewhere, watching the gate. He's got the key. If I don't walk out of the gate and give him the right signal, he stays quiet and keeps the key with him. You get nothing."
He glanced at Padraic again, then looked back at Kelisandra. Kelisandra set her mouth in a tight frown and waved Padraic back.
"So, selling me the location of the door and the key to open it you are. Your price?"
"Oh, there's a lot of folk around here I'd love to get my hands on," Ambrose replied. "Sicarius and the elf are high on my list, but looks to me as if they're high on yours as well. Don't care who kills them, to be honest, so long as someone does."
Padraic couldn't hold back a snort of laughter at that, and Ambrose gave him a conspiratorial nod.
"Those two are yours, far as I'm concerned, but there's a Sabrian as well, traveling with the elf. I want him and everything he owns."
"Why?"
Kelisandra asked, raising an eyebrow. Ambrose shook his head.
"That's not part of what I'm selling. I want the Sabrian alive and everything he's carrying. His blades, his clothes, books, papers, coins in his pockets, all of it. If you agree, I'll guide you to the door right now. You have my word."
Kelisandra shook her head.
"So, just sit next to the door while we go in and fetch this Sabrian, will you? As for your word, what's that worth? Don't know you, don't know what you hold dear."
She smiled as Ambrose glared at her.
"We've a saying back home. Can't take a man at his word, then take the man himself."
She looked him up and down.
"You've the look of a man who's trained with a blade. So, here's how it'll go. Give you a sword, we will, and you'll take my lads not just to the door, but through it. Fight alongside them, earn their respect, earn my trust. After the abbey's taken for the sun, the Sabrian's yours, and you're free to go where you will. Swear by the sword and shield I do that it'll be done as I said. Fair and fair?"
Fair and fair, Ambrose answered, spitting in his palm and holding out his hand. Kelisandra did the same.
Donal, she ordered, put a blade in this man's hand and reform the squad you led at the gate.
Donal nodded and gestured for Ambrose to follow him down the stairs. Patrick stepped up to her.
Mum, he whispered, don't keep me out of this one, please.
She looked him in the eye and nodded.
Take Rorik's blade. Redeem his honor and yours.
Patrick's bruised face split in a wolfish grin as he accepted the weapon from her, then darted for the stairs after Donal.
Sun's blessing upon you, Patrick, Kelisandra called after him. Bring the elf to me, alive if you can, her head if you can't.
Why didn't you tell me you'd been here as a boy? Kerla called ahead to Teska as he led them through the narrow tunnel. By unspoken agreement, they'd put Jordan at the front of the line between them. Yvette and Allie were further back in the line between Grievous and Wick, and while both women were keeping their promises, both left hands felt there was no point putting temptation within reach by letting either of them get too close to Jordan.
I forgot, Teska said over his shoulder. I was only 6 or so at the time, but more importantly, there's something Farran did to make me forget meeting him.
That's one of his favorite tricks, Jordan muttered. Count yourself lucky he only did it to you once.
Teska nodded.
Well, I think that also made my memories of this entire place more remote, much harder to recall. Were you able to find out why my family came here?
I didn't get a chance, Kerla replied. All I found out was that he and a woman named Moira Delane gave interviews.
Interviews, Teska said, half to himself. That sounds familiar.
Kerla watched him. Who was Moira? You never mentioned her before.
Teska paused. Moira. Oh, I haven't thought about her for a long time. She was my sister's wet nurse, I think. At least at first. After Rose was weaned, she stayed with us, became my father's business partner.
He nodded.
Yes, that sounds right. She helped him run the caravans, but she didn't come south into the Empire with us, and Father never told us why.
He shook his head ruefully, coming back from wherever his memories had taken him.
Watch your feet through here, the stone's slippery.
Kerla passed his warning down the line, then turned back to watch him. The joy at seeing Teska again was so intense it was almost painful, and she felt a wave of guilt wash over her when she realized that some part of her still didn't believe it. She knew the reason. Losing Teska the first time had been agony. If she fully accepted that he was back, and then discovered it wasn't true, the pain would be 10 times worse. So she studied him very, very closely, looking for something out of place, anything that suggested this was some sort of trick.
I was inches from his face, she thought. There's no disguise that would have fooled me at that distance. Not a human disguise, anyway. But what about an illusion? Could that be Farran ahead of me, posing as Teska?
Thinking about how Titus Satax had fooled everyone, she stopped watching Teska directly and instead concentrated on traversing the wet rock beneath her feet, keeping him in her peripheral vision, seeing what the corner of her eye could tell her.
It's not Farran, she decided quickly. An illusion might change his face, maybe even his voice, if that's possible, but it can't change the way he moves.
The man ahead of her had the same smooth grace that she had seen so many times before, and she was reminded of Allie's comment. Watching Teska move was like listening to music.
The way he puts every foot exactly where it needs to be. The only other person I've ever seen move like that is Titus Satax. That's the Agentes training. Farran wouldn't be able to fake that. He looks the same, sounds the same, moves the same. So what is it about him that's different? She asked herself. There is something.
A few minutes later, Teska paused.
Here's the gate.
But we closed it on the way in, Jordan reminded him, and Satax kept the key.
Kerla had started to come forward even as Teska began to turn his head to look in her direction. Both of them grinned as they realized their rapport was as strong as ever.
That's something else Farran couldn't fake,
Kerla thought as she knelt in front of the gate to examine the lock. But she still couldn't shake the feeling that now there was something different about her friend. Teska stood over her, holding the lantern to shine on the gate.
What do you think?
She put a hand on the lock, projecting her awareness into the mechanism. Iron, and high quality, and there's hardly any rust. Someone's been keeping the mechanism clean and oiled.
Probably Ferran, Teska commented. Will that make this harder?
Oh yes, a rusty lock's much easier to break than a new one.
Break? Jordan asked. You're going to...
Yvette spent 10 minutes trying to pick this lock on our way in, Teska interrupted him gently. We need to keep moving.
But if you break the lock, Jordan objected, then this gate is wide open. Anyone who finds it can get into the abbey unopposed.
As soon as Hallam tells the abbot about Ferran's tunnel, Teska assured him, they'll put some new defense down here that's probably much better than one iron gate.
It's too great a risk, argued Jordan.
Jordan, we're not debating this.
No, we're not, Jordan said. I order you not to break the lock.
Kerla, who was still looking at the lock, froze. Part of her wanted to turn around to see the looks on both Jordan's and Teska's faces, but another, wiser part of her knew it was better to stay out of this.
You order me, Teska asked.
Yes, the youth said, gathering confidence. I am Jordan Kohaya, son and heir of Duke Stephen Kohaya, and as the left hand of my father, you are ordered to find us another way to get this gate open.
The tunnel echoed with the ring of Jordan's command, sharp and clear. A moment later, Teska spoke.
Kerla, take note, the left hand said formally. He has acknowledged his lineage before witnesses.
So noted, she replied.
My lord, Teska went on, bowing before Jordan, I welcome you into your inheritance. Your order is heard and understood.
Kerla, break the lock.
What? Jordan sputtered. But I...
My lord, Teska interrupted, you are accorded the respect due your rank, but I only answer to your father. Those circumstances may change after we return to Kohane and you are formally invested, but for now, my orders are to bring you home, not to defend the abbey. We're too easily trapped down here and blind to any change of events on the surface, so the wisest course of action is to get out of here as quickly as possible.
He held up a hand before Jordan could reply.
My lord, the subject is closed.
Jordan made an inarticulate noise in protest, turning away, but being unable to storm off as he wanted, slumped against the tunnel wall in a sulk. Grievous, who was next in line, leaned in close to him, speaking in Sabrian.
Teska crouched down next to Kerla.
That could have gone better, he said in a low voice.
He loves this place, she said in the same quiet tone, and he's as stubborn as a mule. I've already been tempted at least once to tie him to a horse and haul him out of here, so you're not doing so badly.
Teska chuckled. He doesn't want to leave the abbey?
He does, she assured him. He really, really does. He just doesn't want to leave the abbey behind, if you take my meaning. And he has a point. Breaking this lock is a threat to the abbey's safety.
The real threat is Ferran's tunnel. If Kelisandra learns of it, one single iron gate won't be enough to stop the Mother of Steel. And I can't shake the feeling that we need to get above ground as quickly as possible.
Trust your gut, Kerla said. You taught me that. Well, I can break this lock, but to do it fast, I'll have to tap into my own strength. And as you said before, you're hoping to set a hard pace.
I thought the mana was stronger here than on the quad.
It is. But this is a very good lock, and the iron is undamaged. There's not enough mana around us for me to break it quickly.
Teska gave her an odd smile, uncharacteristically reminding her for a moment of an excited child with a present behind his back.
How much more mana would you need?
What?
I've got something to show you, something that's happened to me since the battle.
And as Kerla watched, Teska's eyes changed, his pupils dilating in a way she'd seen Ferran's do when he watched her demonstrate her repair spell. She frowned, feeling something changing around her as Teska put out his open hand, then slowly closed it into a fist. The mana around her grew thicker, reminding her of her childhood when she'd been traveling on the mainland, and suddenly she was aware of Teska in a way she'd never really been aware of a human before. She expanded her own vision, seeing the mana around her as much as feeling it, and she gasped. Mana was gathering around Teska's fist, around his entire body, swirling like water slowly stirred in a glass.
"How are you doing that?"
she whispered, awestruck and more than a little scared.
"Is that enough?" Teska asked, his voice touched with effort. "I can pull in more. It's just hard to hold on to for long."
"No, no, that's enough,"
she said, turning to a task she could understand with grateful desperation, weaving a spell of entropy into the lock's mechanism.
"Hold on to that, however you're doing it, just a little longer."
She double-checked the pattern, making a few adjustments to improve its efficiency, then let it go. The extra mana Teska had drawn around them was sucked into the pattern, which attacked the iron of the lock like a swarm of ants on a lump of sugar. A fine powder of red rust fell away as the iron pitted and cracked, the lock coming apart in moments. With a sad creak of metal hinges, the gate slowly swung free into the tunnel before them. Kerla stared back at Teska.
"Now, what was that?"
she demanded.
"I scared you," Teska said, his eyes returning to normal. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I just wanted to surprise you."
"You certainly did," Kerla said with a nervous laugh.
She was still looking at him with her expanded vision, and she now saw what it was that was different about him, what she had felt before but couldn't identify. Mana responded to his presence, displacing around him, leaving small eddies curling around his body as it went past, and it was that displacement she could feel, the faint stirring of current around him. And yet, the longer she stared at Teska, the more natural his presence felt. Suddenly, she thought of the flame wing, and Ferran's explanation to why some animals were gaining strange powers.
"Not gaining," she corrected herself, "regaining. And if it's happening to animals, why not humans, too?"
Teska saw the expression on her face change.
"Do you know what's happened to me?"
"No," she admitted, "but I think I've got a few pieces to add to the puzzle. When we get back to Maipur, there's a tavern I found that serves a really, really good rum. We should buy a bottle of it, find a quiet corner, and catch each other up on everything that's happened since the battle."
"Tempting," Teska admitted, "if we had the time for it."
She put her hand on his.
"We need to make time for it. You knew how old Jordan was, didn't you?"
"Yes, of course," Teska replied, puzzled.
Then he sighed.
"But I didn't tell you."
"No, you didn't. I was expecting to find a boy, maybe 9 or 10 years old, not a young man. And I'm sure there's other things that would have been good to know."
Teska shrugged.
"The Duke and Galen felt you weren't ready to handle the full details of the mission, at least not unless something happened to me."
"But we lost the copy of those written orders, and then we never made the time for you to tell them to me instead," Kerla told him. "I think I did all right operating half-blind, but we can't afford to do that again."
"You're right," Teska said. "So, we'll make the time. What's the name of this tavern?"
"Strabo's Rest."
She laughed at his puzzled reaction.
"Trust me, there's a really good story behind the name."
"I look forward to hearing it," Teska said as he stood up. "You're buying the bottle, though. Any money I had on me sank along with the Lee Rouge."
"Any excuse to get out of paying a bar tab," she said with a grin, the last of her doubts about who she was talking to gone at last.
Jordan remained silent and sullen as they passed through the gate, quickly arriving at the side passage that led to the well shaft, but as Teska shined the lantern on the elliptical hole in the tunnel roof, the youth couldn't hold back his curiosity.
"How did Ferran make this?" he asked in wonder.
"Not sure," Kerla said, climbing up to get a better look. She put a hand on the smooth stone, running her fingers along one of the depressions set into the base of the tunnel to get a handhold. If I set the pattern for the entropy spell into the rock, but didn't let it go, that might be the start of it. Then I could adjust the pattern, push the rock into another shape instead of break...
Kerla, Teska's voice cut into her reverie.
Right, right. She dropped back down and took off her backpack, withdrawing a quantity of slender rope. Teska half-drew his sword, and she used the edge to saw the rope into several lengths, each about 4 feet long. These she handed out to Grievous, Wick, and Allie, keeping one for herself. We won't fit in there carrying our gear, so tie one end to your pack and the other end to your belt. Drag it up after you.
And make sure everything's secure, Teska warned. This comes out into the well shaft, but I don't know how far down the well goes. If you drop something, we probably can't get it back.
I'll go first, Kerla said. I can see what's out there and tell you if the coast is clear.
All right, Teska said. Wick, you'll follow.
Aye, sir.
Kerla checked everyone's ropes, then climbed up into the shaft, her gear trailing along behind her. The faint breeze on her face and gleam of reflected moonlight ahead made her smile, and a moment later she stuck her head into the well shaft, a row of handholds in the stone rising above her. After a moment working her pack out of the hole and letting it hang beneath her, she started climbing. A few moments later, she raised her head above the lip of the well, quickly taking in her surroundings. The farmhouse was a short distance to her right, and directly ahead of her, further off, was the remains of the pilgrims' camp. There were no lights or other signs of human presence there. Most of the tents were gone, taken inside the abbey, she supposed, while others hung half-collapsed, abandoned and gray in the moonlight. Beyond the camp, the abbey's gate was open, and she could see some light spilling through, and the glow of torches edging the battlements atop the wall. It felt like hours since she'd entered the preservatory in pursuit of Jordan, and she savored the fresh air as she climbed out of the well and untied the rope from her waist. There was some noise from inside the abbey, but nothing she would have identified as the clamor of battle. Is the attack over? She wondered. Could Kelisandra have already taken Midgate? If she's already pushed on to Highgate, maybe I couldn't hear it from out here. She felt guilty at abandoning the monks, but she also felt proud of herself for judging the situation correctly, sensing an opportunity for escape and proceeding with her mission. She heard sounds of effort coming from the well and glanced down to see Wick struggling to get his backpack out of the tunnel. Can you see where to climb out? She called down. The guard turned his head to look up.
Well enough, he grunted after a moment. Be up there shortly, mistress.
It's all right, she said. Don't rush. There's no one else up here. She turned at the sound, a thump of something small and solid hitting the ground and bouncing away through the grass. A rock, she realized, whirling back to see where it had come from, and ducked just in time to avoid the slashing blade of the man rushing at her from the darkness. Kerla sprang away from the well, dodging another swing.
Mistress, Wick called from the well, are you all right?
The man came on again, more slowly, like a cat gathering itself for another spring. In the moonlight, Kerla saw the pale, once white garb of a pilgrim, but then she took in the man's thick features, his half-regrown blonde hair, and she recognized him.
Garrick Cabot, she breathed.
The smuggler's face was terrifying. His eyes were wide, blazing with hatred, but the rest of his face hung on him like a mask of dead flesh. The smile that twisted his lips looked as if someone was pulling wires attached to the corners of his mouth.
Right again, Will, Cabot muttered. Always said every rabbit's got a bolt hole.
His laugh came out more like a grunt, as if someone had poked him in the stomach.
Wait here while the others get help, you said. Sabrian's used it. She will, too.
He took a step closer.
Ma always said you were the smart one.
Stay back, Kerla warned, raising her hands. You don't want to end up like your brother.
Do your worst, witch,
Cabot growled, his voice becoming more animated, more alive.
You burned me once. I've no fear of the flames now.
And he sprang. Cabot was fast, but Kerla was ready for him, dodging to the left. She kept circling in that direction, trying to keep Cabot's back to the well, where she could hear Wick struggling and cursing as he made his way up the shaft. "Cabot's a brawler, not a swordsman," she thought. "Wick can take him. Just have to keep out of his reach until then." But Cabot was too familiar with stalking prey to be fooled by this ploy, and on his next attack, he feinted in one direction, then charged in another, driving her away from the well, toward the farmhouse. Now he was the one leading the dance, herding her toward the building, cutting off her retreat. But Carla didn't panic. She remembered seeing scaffolding on that side of the house, pilgrims doing repairs. "Even better than a ship's rigging. I can climb a lot faster than he can." "Now, Will," Cabot shouted, leaping forward, and Carla backed up again, but this time her foot caught on something in the grass. As she fell, for a moment she thought she saw a hand clutching her ankle, but then she realized it was a plank of wood hidden in the grass, detritus from the construction work. She rolled to one side as Cabot's sword came down, slicing into the soft earth. Cabot started to pull the blade loose, but it got stuck, and as he tugged harder, Carla rolled back toward him, leaping onto his shoulders. Her plan was to paralyze him, just as she had done with Patrick, but she needed a firm grip to transfer the spell, and she'd taken the sword priest by surprise. As she tried to clamp her hands around Cabot's head, the smuggler brought his free hand up, twisting into her hair, and pulled. She screamed in pain, frantically grabbing his shirt as he pulled her over his head and flung her to the ground, his filthy tunic coming halfway off. She crashed into the wooden scaffold, stars bursting behind her eyes. Blearily, she saw Cabot pulling the tunic down, the top of his head emerging from the rough linen. Carla flung one hand toward him and snapped her fingers, pouring mana into her spell. With a whoof, the pilgrim's rough-spun shirt ignited, bathing Cabot's head in flame. She expected him to scream or show some other sign of panic, but Cabot's only reaction was a single grunt of surprise, both hands coming up to yank the fiery cloth off of his head. But he had let go of his sword. As Cabot flung the shirt away, Carla sprang for the blade, ignoring the blinding pain in her head as she finished pulling it out of the ground. Cabot swung back to face her, smoke rising from the remains of his eyebrows and hair, but the sudden blaze of light in his face had left him night-blind, and Carla dodged beneath his swinging arms and launched herself into his chest, the sword thrust in front of her. Cabot staggered under the impact, falling back onto the grass with Carla on top of him. His arms wrapped around her, crushing the breath from her lungs, but a moment later they lost coordination, buffeting her from side to side in ever feebler spasms. Carla endured Cabot's death throes, staring into the man's eyes, watching the gleam of hatred in them flicker and fade. "Say hello to your brother for me," she panted. Cabot opened his mouth to speak, but all that came out was a bubbling, bloody gurgle, and the gleam in his eyes went out at last.
"Mistress!"
Carla wearily raised her head to see Wick hauling himself out of the well, half falling over the lip as he tried to set his feet down, pull his luggage up after him, and draw his sword at the same time.
"Mistress!"
he called out, turning in a circle.
"Carla!"
"Wick!" Carla called. "I'm over here. It's all right." The guard whirled in her direction, coming at a run. With a groan, she pushed herself off of Cabot and stood up. She had to put a foot on Cabot's chest to brace herself as she tugged the sword free.
"A pilgrim?"
Wick asked, skidding to a halt next to her.
"I don't think so. Take a look. It's Garrick Cabot."
Wick squinted, bending down to look more closely.
"Cabot? We left him back on the quad. What in the hells is he doing here?"
"I don't know," Carla said, pulling Cabot's sword belt off of him to take the blade's sheath for her own. "He must have followed us somehow, but he said something about others going to get help."
Wick looked up sharply.
"There's more coming."
"We have to assume so."
She wiped her new blade clean on Cabot's pant leg, then sheathed it.
"Get back to the well and stay alert. Pass the word down that there might be more trouble coming."
"Where are you going?"
She pointed to the farmhouse roof, "to get a better look around." Wick nodded, trotting back to the well. After buckling Cabot's sword to her own belt, Carla climbed up into the scaffolding next to the building, then pulled herself onto the roof. Her head throbbing, her limbs shaking, she settled herself down near the peak of the roof and settled her thoughts. "Garrick Cabot," she said to the night air, remembering something Tesca had told her. It was a rare thing for folk in their trade to know the names of those that had to be moved from their path, so those few names they did learn were important to remember. "I won't be forgetting you, Garrick," she said with a shudder, recalling the man's face. "You mentioned your mother. I suppose she's back in Kohane somewhere, wondering what happened to her boys." She sighed. "At least there's one out there to mourn you." She looked out toward the camp, watching for any signs of movement. The problem was that although her night vision was very good, she still needed some light to see, and there were no campfires, torches, or lamps among the collapsed and ruined tents, only the moonlight, which washed out colors and details, especially at this distance. So she closed her eyes and listened, identifying each sound and pinpointing its location. The closest sound was, of course, around the well. Someone else had already come up to join Wick. She recognized Jordan's voice, heard him asking Wick where she was. And a fourth person was already climbing out, a man. "Has to be Grievous," Carla thought. "Tesca will certainly bring up the rear." She paused, grinning. "That means he's down there alone with Yvette and Allie. As if those tunnels weren't chilly enough." She moved her focus further out, concentrating on sounds that were coming from farther away, tilting her head and slowly turning it to help pinpoint the directions they were coming from. Still fairly quiet in the direction of the abbey, there's some movement, perhaps those are the others Cabot was talking about. Another person came out of the well. Yvette this time, and there's Allie coming up after her. "Almost done. That's good. We need to get moving." She got to her feet and was about to turn back to the scaffolding when she realized there was another sound out there, very faint, much farther off, a dull rumble. "Thunder? No, the sky's clear, and I've seen no lightning, even on the horizon. And thunder would have stopped by now, but this sound's still going." She frowned. "The underground river," she guessed. "The monks put it on a different course. Maybe that would explain the noise." When she reached the ground, Allie had already climbed out of the well, and Tesca's head appeared over the lip as she reached the rest of the group. "Where did you get the sword?" he asked, spotting the weapon on her hip immediately. "Garrick Cabot," she replied, seeing a look of alarm, but not surprise, pass between Tesca and Yvette. "He was waiting for... well, he was waiting for me. I think he saw the Sabrians climb out of the well and realized this must be a way in and out of the abbey." "Is Cabot dead?" Yvette asked. When Carla nodded, the Hizveshian looked impressed and gave Carla a quick bow as a compliment. "More important," Tesca cut in, "was he alone?" His gaze flicked toward Allie as he asked the question. "Yes," Carla replied, guessing in that glance who might have been in Cabot's company. "But he talked about others going to get help." Tesca nodded. "Then let's get moving." He pointed past the farmhouse. "We'll head toward the barn and circle around the perimeter of the camp, staying clear of the abbey gate. Then we'll loop back to the road and head straight for Maipur." He raised the shuttered lantern, a few points of light gleaming around the closed aperture. "I won't open this until we've gotten to the road, so stay close. There may still be some patrols out there."
"But they don't have any horses," Yvette added, "so if we can get past them unawares, they shouldn't be able to catch us." "Want me to take the lead?" Carla asked.
"No, I've got it," Tesca said. "I know the terrain. I want you at the back, listening for any sounds of alarm or pursuit. Wick, you stay up with me. If we meet a patrol, we can't let any of them get away. Understood?"
"Understood, sir."
Carla let the others move out before bringing up the rear. She was surprised at Tesca's decision. The moonlight wasn't enough for a human to see more than 10 to 15 feet ahead. But he and Wick were best suited to handle a patrol if they stumbled into one. By unspoken agreement, Jordan was between her and Grievous, once again separated from Yvette and Allie by at least one body length.
"How are you holding up?" she asked the youth in a low voice.
Jordan shrugged. "The parcel is fine."
"Parcel?"
Jordan looked annoyed as he pointed to himself. "I'm just the package being delivered. It's not like I have anything to contribute."
"Jordan?"
"No," he cut her off. "I understand. You don't have to worry about me."
She sighed in exasperation, sensing that he was spoiling for an argument. Knowing better than to take the bait, she said nothing, and Jordan settled into a sullen, plodding silence.
Tesca led them around the farmhouse and across the patchy lawn to a dilapidated wooden fence. She was surprised to see him steer unerringly toward a gate in the fence, opening it and passing through. The group followed and continued toward the black shape of the barn ahead of them. Tesca adjusted his course, steering slightly to the right of the barn, now taking them away from the camp.
"He really does know the terrain," she thought. "Or is it more than that?"
The faint rumbling noise was getting stronger.
"Maybe we're getting close to the river's course now," she thought. "An underground waterfall or something like that."
She frowned.
"But I've been near waterfalls before, and they make the ground shake too when you're close to them. I'm not feeling anything like that. So if it's not the river, then what is..."
Then she heard voices and movement from the abbey, suddenly getting louder. She stopped and turned, hearing Jordan stop as well.
"What is it?" he asked. "Lights," she said. "Torches coming out of the abbey. At least 10, maybe 20 people."
"I see them," Jordan said, squinting. Then he caught his breath. "They're heading for the well."
"We can't be sure yet," she tried to tell him, but her words died in her throat.
The group was headed in the direction of the farmstead, and Garrick Cabot had said that others had gone to get help. It was too much of a coincidence.
"The abbot doesn't know about the well yet. They'll take the monks by surprise," Jordan said weakly.
"They'd have to find their way to the surface first," Carla said. "I never would have navigated that maze without that trail you left for us. Who knows how long they'll be lost down there?"
"Among the archives," Jordan said. "Carrying torches."
Carla heard something in his voice change, a decision made, and she started to turn toward him, realizing what he was about to do, but Jordan was already in motion. In the next instant, one of his hands was at her waist, snatching Cabot's sword. Then with his other hand, Jordan shoved her hard, sending her sprawling to the ground.
"Jordan, no!"
she cried as the youth sprinted into the darkness, angling his run to cut the mob off.
"Tesca! Tesca!"
There was a stifled curse behind her, then heavy footsteps as Tesca hurtled past, Wick only a few steps behind. Carla scrambled to her feet and took off after them, Grievous, Allie, and Yvette in her wake. This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.